Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
Scientists say the long-awaited El Niño weather pattern is finally arriving in the Pacific. But can it keep the state from completely drying up?
Godzilla El Niño.
El Niño.
El Niño.
El Niño.
Is gaining strength in the Pacific. If so, California could finally get the drought-busting storms it desperately needs.
We're all waiting to see how El Niño will affect our thirsty state. One thing's for sure, after 4 years of severe drought, it will not be enough to fix all the problems in the Central Valley, America's agricultural garden. Crops have been fallowed, farmers are fighting the authorities and their neighbors, and farm workers are being thrown out of work. Photographer Matt Black documents all that in Unflinching Black and White. Magazines like The New Yorker have published his photo essays, and he was Time Magazine's Instagram Photographer of the Year last year. Matt Black grew up and still lives in the Central Valley. He told me he's seen a lot of changes since he first started taking photos there 2 decades ago.
The biggest change, really, and it kind of extends beyond the current drought, although that's a part of it, is just a kind of steady decline, really, in water, the amount of water for agriculture. For an example, you know, when I was a kid growing up in the valley, when they'd irrigate the crops in the summer, they would put on so much water that you'd step outside, you know, in 100-degree heat, and it'd be humid, you know, from all the evaporation going on. Now, in the Central Valley, everything is on drip line, plastic lines that irrigate the crops, even things like cotton. And, you know, the air and, you know, everything is drier, like a era, really, of constriction. You know, just kind of across the board stemming from that. And of course, with the drought and, you know, on the heels of the driest year in recorded history in California, and then looks like we're entering another year of drought, it's just been a steady decline with the time.
And what does it look like? I mean, you described really well how it feels with the air being drier now.
Yeah.
What does it look like?
Literally, I mean, you can go to certain parts of the Central Valley, and it's a desert, you know. I mean, tumbleweeds and creosote and, you know, all these things that, you know, haven't been visible in that area for, you know, 100 years since, you know, farming first started. But, you know, in parts of the valley, these things are, it's reverting back to that. Disturbing. It's disturbing, you know, and everyone knows the kind of complications of water and water politics in California. You know, they get ornate, but kind of, you know, coming at just from someone who's from there, who lives there, and, you know, grew up in this environment, there is something just kind of profoundly disturbing to watch this empire, really, this agricultural empire, revert back to, you know, dust, essentially.
But the agribusiness isn't going to let that happen, because this is one of the richest areas of the world in terms of produce.
That's right. But we are seeing, you know, I mean, last year alone, there's 500,000 acres taken out of production, gone.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of, you know, farming really realistically is kind of hanging on by this thread. And it's really, everyone knows it's unsustainable thread, which is, you know, groundwater. I mean, thousands of wells were sunk last year to try to tap these aquifers and keep these crops alive, particularly tree crops. And so much water is being pumped out from underground, you know, just recently, within the last year, that the, you know, the ground is actually starting to settle, to collapse.
And with the fallowing of the land because of the drought, because there's no water, that means that the people who worked that land no longer have jobs.
That's right. You know, they're very rarely included in any kind of, you know, part of this discussion. And for me, that's where the kind of bottom line is how are, you know, the scores, hundreds of little towns scattered throughout the Central Valley and people's lives, you know, how are they being affected by all this?
So, and how are they being affected? Can you describe what their lives are like now?
It's a steady decline. I mean, it's, you know, Central Valley and these communities have always been, you know, high poverty areas, right? That's nothing new. But what is new is that this thing that could always be kind of counted upon, even if the wages were meager and even if the return to the community was small, you know, it was there. It was this engine that drove these places. Well, I mean, you know, without that, if that's going to disappear, you know, what's going to become of these places? And this whole part of California, really, that is, you know, important. It's dear to me. And I don't think anyone really is clear on what's going to come next. You know, I don't hear any answers coming from anyone.
A lot of your photos there, they really just reminded me of photos I saw from the 1930s, from the Dust Bowl, from the WPA project. And I'm wondering if you consciously wanted to evoke that when you took these photos. They're in black and white. They're stark. They're pictures of really dire living conditions, people living in shanty towns, shacks, actually. They have no running water. Pictures like that. Did you consciously want to evoke images of the Dust Bowl?
No, not precisely. I mean, when I started in photography, this was in the late 1980s, I actually learned photography at a small newspaper in the Central Valley, and that's what photography was. It was black and white, and it was 35 millimeter and full frame, all of these kind of this classic form of photojournalism that was really right at its kind of end. This is when newspapers still published, you know, black and white photography. And I just kind of, I fell in love with that craft, you know, and the language of that. And I just haven't seen any reason to change. I mean, I think if I was, in all honesty, if I was to start now as a photographer, it would be an odd choice to choose to photograph in black and white. But for me, it's really important, you know, over this time that, you know, a photo I take tomorrow, I can put right next to a photo I took 20 years ago, and they're the same. And that's really, you know, what I've been doing. It's this process of engagement, right, and reporting on this particular region over this period of time. And, you know, the fact that, you know, photographing it in black and white in this classic form, you know, gives the work this consistency that I really like. Plus, it's, you know, it's a way of looking, it's a way of seeing the world that suits me, that fits me well.
What do you mean by that? It's a way of looking at the world that fits you, that suits you.
Well, I mean, there's a certain, you know, there's a certain starkness to that way of photographing, and there's a certain starkness to what I photograph, you know. I mean, you know, the dry environment and then the social conditions that are so rough, it just, you know, it's all there. And then for me, you know, fundamentally about the subject of the photograph, it's not, you know, necessarily about the color of light or the quality of light or all these things. It's, you know, in black and white lets you kind of strip down to the basic forms of what's being photographed, and you can tune out, you know, clashing colors and all those things that can sometimes interfere.
And you grew up in a town called Exeter. What's it like there?
Okay, well, I grew up nearby in a town called Visalia. It's the same general area.
Yeah.
And then moved over to Exeter. Exeter is a small kind of farming town. A lot of citrus is grown around there. It's about 10,000 people. And it's, you know, it's pretty typical Central Valley town. My father actually was an engineer and worked on some of the big kind of irrigation projects in the valley. So got a little insight into that world through him. And then my mother taught school.
So what is your father think of the changes and this issue of the drought, the water, and how the water politics are playing out?
Well, I think a lot of people, you know, in the Central Valley feel like, regardless of, you know, their personal stance on, you know, the way a lot of these issues have been cast of, you know, the environment versus farming or, you know, the urban versus rural, all those things, I think a lot of people feel, my dad included, myself included, that, you know, this huge investment has gone into making this place, making the Central Valley bloom, right?
Mm-hmm.
Over nearly 50 years now. And it's just, it's sad to watch that crumble, you know, to watch that just kind of fall apart. You know, I don't think anyone would feel like that's a positive thing.
Yeah. And as you say, you've been doing this for many, many years, for 20 years or so. And just last year, you were Time Magazine's Instagram Photographer of the Year. How did that change anything, if it did, in terms of how people view your photography and the message that you're trying to get out?
Well, over, you know, I've been doing this work as a photojournalist, really, and I'm publishing the work in, you know, newspapers and magazines from the beginning. It's always been my intention, but, you know, as most people know, over the past 10 years or so, the magazines and newspapers have really taken a hit and are now being replaced by the internet and other ways that people have engaging with stories. So it's a challenge for myself and all photographers, really, is how to kind of bridge that gap. So about a year ago, I turned to Instagram with this kind of very conceived project dealing with poverty, in particular in the Central Valley, and with no clue as to how it would be received. You know, to my pleasure, it was received well, and people are, you know, willing to engage, want to engage, it seems, on that platform and on other social media platforms too, with like serious issues. So it's a, you know, there's a ray of hope there for journalists like me who like to work on long-term stories, in-depth stories, that, you know, we're not necessarily tied to a particular publication or a newspaper or the health of the media industry in general. We can go out and do this work on our own and, you know, find an audience for it.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Matt, I appreciate it. Thank you, Madeline.
That's Matt Black. He's a photojournalist documenting the historic drought in California's Central Valley. He also has photographs of his projects in Mexico. All of that, all the photographs, you can see at his website, mattblack.com. Actress Amber Tamblyn is also a writer, and she's written a book of poetry about young Hollywood actresses who died too soon. That's next on Press Play.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day, and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive Angel Clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. When Hollywood chews, a young actress either gets spit out or swallowed whole. Evidence: Jean Harlow, Marilyn Monroe, Brittany Murphy. It's these actresses and more, actresses who've died, eaten up by Hollywood in one way or another, who inspired actress Amber Tamblyn's latest collection of poetry. Here's Amber Tamblyn reading from her poem, Untitled Actress.
Logline: a woman fights to save her soul. Think a young Carol Lombard meets a younger Anna Nicole. Requires an actress that will leave an audience speechless, who's found her creative voice, not a speaking role.
And Amber Tamblyn is here now to talk about her collection. It's called Dark Sparkler. Welcome.
Hi.
This is not your first collection of poetry.
No, it is not. It's my third.
And tell me about your life as an actress and whether you're still in it fully, or are you fully in the poetry writing part?
I think I'm more into acting than I ever have been. I think for me, I've been acting since I was 11 years old. I grew up on a soap opera and
General Hospital.
General Hospital.
Must be said.
And I never really took a break from acting. I'm 31 now. I never took a break until this book started to be written. And this was really, I think, my exploration question to myself as to whether or not I had a choice in that matter. You know, for a lot of child actors, you don't know. You just keep going. But I didn't know if I ever really had a choice in the matter.
Mm. And so you decided to research all these other actresses who met tragic ends?
After I wrote the poem for Brittany Murphy in 2009, after she died, it sort of sparked this curiosity in me, and also a lot of writers that I know, like Roxane Gay, who wrote Bad Feminist, said to me, sort of pulled me aside and said, look, this is the work you're going to do. This is the next book you're going to write. And I went, oh, yeah, that makes sense. I don't think any of us realized, my friends included and my husband, what kind of spiral it was going to create in my life.
Wow. Well, before we get to that part, the spiral, I want you to talk about this poem, and maybe you can read a little bit from it. Brittany Murphy.
Yeah. The country says good things about the body. They print the best photos, the least bones, the most peach. Candles are lit in the glint of every glam. Every magazine stand does the Southern Belle curtsy in her post-box office bomb honor. The autopsy finds an easy answer. They say good things about the body. How bold her eyes were. Bigger than Hepburn's. The way she could turn into her camera close-up like life depended on her.
What was it about Brittany Murphy that captivated you and made you want to write this poem?
It's the question I ask myself over and over again because I don't know. I don't know why her death was the trigger pulled. You know, perhaps I always had the gun and I just didn't know what I was doing with it. But something about the fact that I didn't know her, but we always went on the same auditions. I would see her name in audition rooms on the casting sign-in sheet. Something about her death, about the fact that I thought she was so talented and so extraordinarily beautiful. And she had begged her parents, from what I understand, to move to Los Angeles at a young age, specifically because she wanted to be an actress. It was the only thing she ever wanted to do. And I have such the opposite experience. I'm a third generation from Los Angeles. You know, my grandparents are from here. My grandfather was in vaudeville. My father, Russ Tamblyn, was in West Side Story. He was a huge actor his whole life. And I had started from a young age by accident. It was somebody came to a school play and saw me and said, we should get her into acting. So it was a very opposite experience. And so I identified in certain ways with her. And then I also identified with her not at all. So I guess I was fascinated by that.
Mm, yeah, because you refer to her in several places in the mm-hmm. in the book, not just in that one poem. You have facts about Brittany Murphy for poem journal entry June 22nd, 2010. So you have these bullet point facts. Mm-hmm. And the last bullet point is Brittany wrote poetry. So it seems that there are many similarities between the two of you.
Well, maybe there are, or maybe I just started to drive the conversation, even in my own journal entries, into trying to figure out the connection. And I think the more that I studied them, their short lives, the more that there would be little tiny hints as to maybe not our common similarities between the two of us, but just their similarities between all women. And I started to see them as human beings, even though I didn't really know them personally.
What are some of the similarities between these actresses? Because there are several actresses in here I had never heard of. Mm-hmm. Not that I'm the final, you know, arbiter of who's famous and who isn't, but there are some names in here. Just let me read a few. Circa Sari, Carol Landis, Anissa Jones, I'd never heard of.
Right. So all the titles of the poems are named after the actresses' names themselves, about I'd say 70% of them you won't recognize, which is the point I'm trying to make about fame, about what we remember, what we don't, what leaves a lasting impression, what doesn't. And a lot of these women were huge stars in their time or were budding stars in a huge way. And then either an accident happened or a death or something that changed the trajectory of their lives. One of the interesting connections I found was between Bridget Anderson, young actress who starred in a film called Savannah Smiles. The long story short for her is that she ended up becoming a very severe drug addict and died, I believe, in her 20s, never really making it past that cute, adorable phase that a lot of child actors go through, and then ultimately they don't become adult film actors anymore. Then later on, there was the porn star Savannah had actually tried to get out of the adult entertainment industry and become an actress. She struggled heavily from mental illness and ended up shooting herself in the head. I'd read an interview where she talked about, they said, where'd you get the name Savannah? Because her real name was Shannon. And she said, oh, my favorite film from childhood is this movie called Savannah Smiles. I really love the main character. I love the idea that she ran away from home and that everybody came after her and wanted to find her. Because, you know, she grew up, I think, with not great parents or not a great home life. So the idea that adults would come find her, she loved that. It was great folklore for her. But had she known that this girl's existence had, you know, the actress that played that role was so similar to her, who knows what the outcome would have been?
Yeah, yeah. Well, now that you're in your 30s and you're no longer a child actress, how has that changed for you, and how do you see yourself aging in this business?
I feel like I've come into a second understanding of who I am. You know, the irony of that is that without the creation of this book, I think in the exploration of these women's deaths, I would not have understood how to have my own rebirth myself, which is really what I needed. It's really difficult, you know, to know that to know what you're capable of, but then at the same time to also know that all you know how to do is audition. All you know how to do is get told yes or no by adults. And then you become an adult. You become the one that's supposed to say yes or no. And then you don't really know how to do that for yourself because you're so used to being dependent on other people. And writing this book and the exploration of women who did not know how to do that and felt helpless and either died of their own volition or of the volition of others was really a way for me to sort of see how different I was and to sort of hone my own power in becoming a woman who wanted to do more than just act.
Was there ever a moment in your life when it could have gone the other way, when it could have gone the way of these women?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, I think a lot of people who've interviewed me and asked me, you know, there's a lot of talk about death in there. I mean, there at one point in the epilogue that's in the back of the book, I say the author died during the writing of this book. And I can see how that would be interpreted as literal. To me, this book staved off creative death. The person who felt helpless, the person who didn't feel like she had control over her life, the person who didn't know how to not feel pigeonholed is gone. That person doesn't exist anymore.
All because you wrote this book?
Yeah. Well, it took 6 years to write. I mean, it wasn't an easy, you know, it was not an easy death for sure.
It's funny, though, because a lot of these young actresses who've died, they're kind of mythologized in their deaths, that their deaths are seen as romantic in a strange way. I mean, Marilyn Monroe will always be a sex goddess because mm-hmm. she never really aged.
Well, you've just touched on something that is so true, which is that it's not just a book about people's deaths. It's a book about voyeurism. It's a book about projection, about how we as a society and a culture project our own feelings about immortalization onto those stars that we love. And then so when they die in a capacity that they are sort of frozen in time forever, it's what we as a culture, especially as a Western culture, and especially in Los Angeles and, you know, the Hollywood business, the idea of being immortal is something that is, for women especially, something that we want, we crave, we need.
You have an entry for Lindsay Lohan, who is still alive, who's mm-hmm. with us, hopefully for a lot longer, and it's an empty page.
Yeah.
Just a blank page.
I always ask people, I say, well, what do you think that means? And then they usually say to me, oh, it's very ominous. You know, you're putting her in here with dead actresses. I said, that's true. But I'm not dead. I'm also in the book. I have 30 pages in the back of it. You know, it's interesting to me that, as I just said, that this is also a book about voyeurism and projection. And really, I think that that poem is my way of saying I'm going to put her in amongst dead actresses because that's what everybody does. That's what we as a culture do. We write her off as dead already. I can't tell you how many articles I've read and things I've seen where they basically state that about her. And it's my way of saying, I'm not going to do that for you. I'm going to put your name in here where everybody else does because I'm making a comment about media and about how they treat you. But I'm actually not going to write the words that say you are dead already because you're not. You are far from it. It's my way of projecting back onto the reader their own personal thoughts about Lindsay.
So ultimately, this is a work of optimism.
Yes, big time.
And hopefulness.
Yes, big time.
And faith in the future, not lights out once you hit a certain age as an actress in Hollywood.
I mean, I think fame actually really doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. The success is within yourself.
Amber Tamblyn, her new book is called Dark Sparkler. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, how Silicon Valley is besotted with smart, techie teens who are dropping out of high school. I'll talk to a teen who moved to the Bay Area and is now making a nice living. That's in a minute after this news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs.
continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. In the world of Silicon Valley, the talent is getting younger and younger. College dropouts? Join the club. High school dropouts are the new hotness. Kids who were skipping school anyway to attend hackathons, kids who've already made apps that land on top 10 most downloaded lists, kids who are bored. Tech journalist Nellie Bowles wrote about them for the California Sunday Magazine. Her article is called Real Teens of Silicon Valley. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me on.
And Jackson Greathouse Fall is one of her subjects, one of the kids who dropped out of school. He's 19 years old now. Hi, Jackson.
Hi there.
Subject. I call him my muse, actually.
I take either, honestly.
Nellie, let's start with you. You open your story describing a living situation. It's called Mission Control in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Can you describe it? Who lives there and what does it look like?
Yeah. So most of the young folks who are moving to San Francisco find sort of communal apartments where they all move in together. And there's a property management firm called Campus that has about 30 of these different apartments that it manages around the city in the Bay Area. And so the teens kind of, they usually have interacted on Facebook or on Twitter, and so they know each other. And then when they move to San Francisco, they already know about these communal houses and apartments. So Mission Control is one of those. And it's pretty fantastic. It's you go above sort of a normal Mexican restaurant, and then you go into sort of a two-story, beautiful, expansive apartment where I'd say like 10 live. How many live there, Jackson?
I'd say around 10, yeah.
Around 10.
Yeah.
Do you live there, Jackson?
And it's pretty minimal. I mean, it's a minimal space.
I personally don't live there, no.
But Jackson lives in another,
I live in another campus house, though.
Yeah.
You do.
Jackson lives in Bernal Heights, and it's sort of staggering water views and the whole thing.
City cliffside, exactly.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Do you live with roommates?
I do. I have 5 roommates.
5.
It just so happens that I have the great opportunity to live with a lot of my best friends.
Five people your age, around your age.
More or less. I'd say the average age is about 21 years old.
Uh-huh.
The living spaces give them kind of a community and a family and a support network. So they often, there are different ages within the houses and they kind of support each other. And some person's really good at talking to VCs, or like Jackson specializes in dressing kids for meetings and helping them like graduate from free startup t-shirts. And so he's sort of known for that. And he stood out. I went to a Mission Control party, and that's how I started reporting this story. And I found all the kids wearing these sort of startup t-shirts. And then there's Jackson in a suit and a button down. And I went up to him and I was like, what are you doing here? And everyone around him was like, oh my God, Jackson dresses us for venture capitalists and for girls. And like, they have kind of a support network within and take care of each other in that way. It's wonderful to see, actually. Huh. And I think that's what gives the parents a lot of trust in letting their kids go, because the parents I talked to talked about seeing these spaces, seeing Mission Control, seeing Jackson's shared house, and seeing this sort of diverse group of ages, some people who dropped out and are now in their 20s, some people who are still 17, and seeing the support network and realizing that their kid will be kind of taken care of by a family in a way.
And by kid, how young are some of the kids in these apartments?
I said about 17 to 21, 22. I think the oldest one was about 22 who I found. And most of them, they'll stay there. So they'll drop out of high school and then go at 17 and then live there for a few years until they get a job that pays enough for their own apartment, or they'll just stay.
I believe Campus has said their target demographic is between college and marriage. So it's quite loose, but it's very, you know, flexible to.
And what is Campus? Can you describe what Campus is?
Yeah, it's a property management group actually started by a Thiel Fellow.
Just to clarify, you mean Peter Thiel, the co-founder of PayPal, who has offered these pretty lavish scholarships, I guess, $100,000 to people who will drop out of college to come work in Silicon Valley if they qualify.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So a lot of this whole movement now really comes from what Peter Thiel originally did a few years ago, which is start these scholarship programs where 20 students a year are given $100,000 to drop out of college. And 20 students a year is a small group. Like, that's not a really significant number, but it was incredibly high profile and it got enormous amounts of publicity. And that's what I met with the Thiel Fellow officers who now run that program. And they were just saying that it's really become a flag for this whole community. And so what happened was that got a ton of press. And then a bunch of other kids felt that they could drop out, even if they weren't going to be Teal Fellows. They felt they could drop out. And it was sort of almost like, here's this thing they can show their parents that gives it some legitimacy. Like, look, there's venture funding in here. There are people encouraging this movement. And so the Teal Fellows are a major part of the community, but it's much bigger than that now.
And so Campus, again, it was founded by one of these Teal Fellows?
Yeah, it's a property management group that runs maybe 30 apartments around the Bay Area, and it's starting to be around the country, that sets up dorm-like experiences for people, either high school or college dropouts. You've got, you know, mattresses on the floor with your sheets, and they provide the detergent, and they provide some basic art, kind of cool art, actually. And then the kids fill it up with the rest and make it really into a home.
So these kids, they are largely adults. I mean, you say some are 17 years mm-hmm. old, but most of them are over the age of 18. And do they act like adults?
Exactly. I think so. I think absolutely. I think they're, you know, there are certain elements of their life that can't be adult. Like this one young, wonderful young man in the story, Zach Latta, is came here and was under 18. I think he was 16 when he came here. And he couldn't join a gym. He can't open a bank account. He once went to a hackathon. Here he's living on his own in his own apartment in San Francisco. He goes to a hackathon to go and work on his skill set, and they won't let him leave the building because he's a minor, an unaccompanied minor. And so then he's trying to call his mom. His mom's not picking up the phone. He's got to get her to give permission to the hackathon runners to let him go home that night. Mm-hmm. And so you do run into situations like that. But the young folks themselves, they absolutely live like adults. They're savvy, like in high demand with venture capitalists, and yet they are almost more adult than a lot of the people I usually interview, in that they're very wary of jumping into any VC-funded operation right away. They're incredibly sharp and savvy. A lot of the reason why they moved out here is because, like, maybe they had an app that had already taken off, and that was a hit app, and so they already were sort of prodigies in their hometowns.
Jackson, you came to Silicon Valley from Oklahoma. What drew you to Silicon Valley, and how old were you?
What initially drew me to Silicon Valley, the whole San Francisco Bay Area, was this network that I'd built up over time. When I was 12, I moved from Los Angeles to Oklahoma City. I immediately found a support network. I was 13 at the time, through Twitter, through Facebook groups.
I forget, how old were you when you came to San Francisco, and your friend was interning, and you were...
So that was last summer, almost a year ago exactly, that I moved from Oklahoma City to Los Angeles. My dear, dear mother suggested that instead of just going out to Los Angeles to visit for a couple weeks, which was what I was initially planning on doing, she said, yeah, Jackson, this was over lunch, totally casually, have you ever considered just buying a one-way ticket? I said, well, actually, no, but that's a really great idea. So I did that. And, you know, I got a bus ticket from L.A. to visit a friend, and I took the 8-hour bus ride from L.A. to San Francisco, and I just fell in love with the city immediately. I remember coming over the I guess it's the 101, when you see the skyline, and then you see all the houses on the hills. Mm-hmm. And then I open up my phone, and there's an app where I could see my friends nearby. And these were all people that I'd never met before, and I saw 20 people within 5 miles of me. And I just knew that this was exactly where I needed to be.
These are the friends you'd made online.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so they were all there. You were 18. And do you have a high school diploma?
I don't, no. I dropped out of high school at the end of my junior year.
Wow. And do you have a GED?
I do not have a GED, no.
Well, okay. So you've decided that you don't need that. You don't need a GED. You don't need a college degree.
What I've told myself is that if I'm ever in a position where I can no longer further my career, either as a designer or as a consultant, because of the fact that I don't have a college degree, then I have nothing against going back to school.
And Nellie, in general, is that the story that you heard over and over again when you were reporting the story?
Yeah. In general, a lot of these kids, like Jackson, were at home making money already. And they get to San Francisco. And if they start a startup, then that's one path. Or they can go freelance. And you can make $200 an hour doing freelance programming or freelance design. There's absolutely money to be made. And so a lot of these kids aren't struggling financially at all. And also, some say, the Teal officers actually told me, and some of the venture capitalists I talked to, and they both said that teenagers may be actually more creative programmers and more creative designers than adults or than people over the teen age. Mm-hmm. There's something about the way a teenager looks at programming or looks at design that may actually be interesting for companies.
So Silicon Valley is all over these teen brains. They can't get enough of them.
Yeah.
Is there any fear, though, that these kids might be exploited, like just, you know, used up and thrown away when they're no longer useful? And I don't know.
I thought that there was. But, you know, I talked to some of the parents. They didn't seem that worried. And the kids themselves, I brought that up with them. Like, are they worried if this fails, or are they just going to be used for their programming energy and then in a little while, or if the boom busts, then what happens and that kind of thing. And what Ryan Orbuch, that teen I was mentioning earlier, said was that I kind of get that, but I'm mostly impressed that people ever start companies when they're in their 30s. And I was like, what? And he was like, then you have so much more to risk. Then you have like a family and an apartment and like a wife and all this stuff. And he's like, now, if I fail, I think he's 18 now. He's like, if I fail, my company doesn't work in 2 years. I just go back home. I go back to Colorado and I go to college and it doesn't matter. It's like,
it's entirely true. Yeah.
They're so young that the risks are minimal.
Mm. I think what's key to keep in mind, though, is the fact that you were saying something like, oh, if the boom bursts or whatever, if the startup fails, if worst case scenario, whatever happens, these teenagers all have highly marketable skills.
Yeah.
They would do terrifically well in any industry. I think they're just drawn to tech because it's the most relevant to their day-to-day lives. But I personally speaking, I could take design into any industry. And a lot of these people could take computer science and anything into any industry, really. It's limitless. It is.
Spoken like a true young person. Jackson Greathouse Fall is an independent designer in San Francisco. He left high school to work in the tech sector, and Nellie Bowles is a tech journalist and contributing writer for the California Sunday Magazine. Her piece on high schoolers dropping out to work in Silicon Valley is out now. Thanks, both of you.
Thank you.
Jazz is back, and its name is Kamasi Washington. He's a composer and tenor saxophonist who has played with Kendrick Lamar, Snoop Dogg, and others, but he's rooted in old school jazz. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. New jazz records don't normally make a lot of news in today's music world, but local tenor sax player and composer Kamasi Washington is bucking that trend. His latest album is called, appropriately, The Epic. It's a 3-CD set featuring dozens of musicians and singers performing almost 3 hours of music. And here's a little of the album's closing track. It's called The Message. Kamasi Washington on the tenor sax there on The Message from his new album, The Epic. And you can hear Kamasi Washington on Kendrick Lamar's new album, To Pimp a Butterfly. He's also played with Snoop Dogg, Lauryn Hill, and Flying Lotus. And Kamasi Washington, welcome to Press Play.
Thanks for having me.
That was wild, that tenor sax playing right there.
Oh, yeah.
How long does that go on?
Oh, it goes on for a few little minutes.
And who's playing drums?
That's two drummers, actually. That's Ronald Bruner and Tony Austin. Uh-huh. And a percussion player, Leon Mobley. So there's a lot of percussion happening right there.
Yeah, and you have 10 members in your group?
Yeah, in the band. Yeah, there's 10 members in the band.
10 members in the band. But on this album, you have many more.
Yeah. It's like the credit list was like a 14-page document. It was like a little mini book.
So how did you collect all these musicians and get them to play on your album?
You know, it's amazing. We all grew up together, like literally like since we were like kids, like before music. Like I met Ronald Bruner and Steven Bruner when I was 3 years old. My dad told me this story. Like I was at my third birthday party, and Ronald's a little younger than me, like maybe like a year and a half. And I got a drum set. for my birthday, and Ronald was like one, and he can already play the drums, and so like he was playing the drums, and apparently I was mad because they were letting the baby play my drums, and I was like, "Why are you letting that baby play my drums?" Because he was like a baby to me. He had like he was still in diapers at
that, and he couldn't even talk.
He couldn't talk, but he could play drums already. Like yeah. Ronald's been dope since he was like 9. He's like you know, he was playing drums in the womb, I think. Yeah.
So all your friends played jazz growing up?
Yeah,
or a
yeah.
lot of them did?
Well, yeah. Well, you know, so Ronald and Steven, who I met first, and then. They went to elementary school with Brandon Coleman and Tony Austin, and that's how I met them. And then I met Ryan Porter in junior high school in Jazz America, and I met Miles and Cameron in high school. So we were all playing music and jazz and yeah, everything else.
And you went to Hamilton High?
Yeah,
I went to Hamilton. In the music department
yep,
there?
Yep, the music academy.
And but this is in the 80s and the 90s. You yep. grew up here in South L.A.?
Yeah, South Central, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Would it be safe to say that most kids your age at that time were listening to hip hop?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Even me too. You know? As I leave, believe I'm stomping, but when I come back, boy, I'm coming straight out of Compton. I really got into jazz, even though my dad's a musician and it was in the house all the time. I didn't really gravitate to jazz for myself until I was about 11. I remember I was like fifth grade or something like that.
And what turned you onto it? Why did you want?
I had a cousin that I really kind of looked up to, and he had this tape, this mixtape that he made of Art Blakey and Lee Morgan songs. And he was kind of like, we were both in the NWA and stuff like that too. Mm-hmm. So I just associated it with, I was like, oh man, Art Blakey is gangster. I got into it. I started telling all my friends. It was like, we had this little clique of people at my elementary school that were into Art Blakey.
Your parents were both musicians.
My dad's a professional musician. My mom plays flute for fun. She's more of a science. She's a science teacher. So my dad was a music teacher and my mom was a science teacher.
And did they introduce you to jazz?
Yeah, yeah. It was funny. Like my dad, when I was really young, he would show me all these records. And then like, but it didn't really catch until like I got that tape. And then it was funny. I would always go back to him like, have you ever heard this record? And he's like, Kamasi, I showed you that record 8 years ago when you were 5. And I'm like, well, have you heard Kind of Blue? Well, have you heard A Love Supreme?
Well, did you know when you were growing up that you were a part of and would be a part of the jazz history of Los Angeles, West Coast jazz? I mean, it's
wow.
Central Avenue. And
that's still seeking in for me, actually.
Really?
I mean, well, growing up, I mean...
Because this is where Dexter Gordon played and Max Roach and Stan Getz.
Yeah, I mean,
all part of this West Coast jazz scene.
I mean, music has always been so close to me. Like, I grew up around all, like, my dad's and his friends are all really brilliant. And so, a lot of the LA jazz musicians, like, I knew them before I played music, you know? And then, so for me, I guess in some way, I always felt like a part of it, but to be a part of it, like, where they respect me, like, on the level, it's kind of like, it's still a little surreal, you know? But once. My friends and I, like, we all grew up together. There was a certain point we got to where I started to realize that we were making some really beautiful music.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with tenor sax player and composer Kamasi Washington. He has a new album out. It's called The Epic. How do you think of your music as different from like East Coast jazz or New York jazz?
I mean, the ironic thing is that, like, you know, in LA and on the West Coast in general, the world of jazz and the world of music in general has kind of like overlooked us. So it's like a gift and a curse. The curse of it is that, like, a lot of musicians that are great musicians have lived their lives in obscurity. But the gift of it is that, to me, West Coast jazz is uninhibited and it's like uninfluenced. So the musicians that I find in LA that are really doing something exciting, they're doing it on their own terms completely. No one is pushing them one way or the other. When I go to New York, they're more specialized because there's a pressure to be specialized. Mm. Here in LA, it's like you just play the music you play. It doesn't have to fit into a genre or a space. You know, it doesn't. There's no rules. That's what's exciting to people. That's why like Kendrick Lamar can make a record like he does and break all these rules. And same thing with me. I just break the rules.
So when you talk about breaking the rules in jazz, what does that look like? Because I don't know, I think as a fan of jazz, I think of jazz as just, that's what it is breaking the rules.
Absolutely, I feel the same way. I think that the lineage of jazz is so big now, and jazz musicians and the society of jazz has suffered from a bit of a destructive level of humility, where we revere what came before so much that we diminish what we're doing now. And there's this sense of like inferiority, like no one likes us, you know, unless you're doing something that sounds like what people were doing in 1965 at the latest. Mm. There's a pressure in jazz to prove that you can play bebop or prove that you can play modal jazz or prove that you listen to Lester Young and all these people. And by the time you've done proving that you have a mastery of this lineage, there's only a little bit of space left for you to do what you do. So I took the opposite approach. I'm like, I'm not going to prove that I know how to do anything. I'm going to just play like I play. And I'm going to let all my band members just play the way you play. And whatever's in there is what's in there. And whatever's not in there is not in there. And I think what happened is that people are getting a larger chunk of individuality, but they're also getting the lineage because the lineage lives in me. I don't have to try to show it. It's just in there. I couldn't get it out of me if I wanted. It's almost like, you know, you're influenced by the ideas that have happened to you before in history, you know. But if I had to prove a mastery of every great figure in history in every conversation I had, you wouldn't get too many of my thoughts. You know, if I had to show I know what Abraham Lincoln thought and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and all these other people, I have to prove that every time I said something, you wouldn't get too many of my ideas. But the fact of the matter is those sort of ideas are already in my mind because I grew up hearing them, listening to them, so they affect who I am. That like we are as relevant as any musician ever, you know. And my band members are my favorite musicians of all time, you know. Like Ronald Bruner to me is as relevant as Tony Williams, and Brandon Coleman is as relevant as Herbie Hancock. I wouldn't trade them for the jazz greats. I wouldn't. Like I love them. I treat them like they are the greats because what we're doing now is relevant to the people. People need what we're doing. Because what we're doing has attached to it the problems and issues of the society that we live in. The things that people need to be healed of now are not the same thing they need to be healed of in 1965. So,
do you see your music as filling that role as a healing role?
Absolutely, yeah.
So something more than just entertainment.
Absolutely, yeah. To me, because like you know, like music saved my life. You know, like growing up in South Central, like I could say, like before I got that tape. You know, I was headed down to a different kind of path. You know, I was
what going kind of path?
I mean, I was a little gangster. I thought I was going to be this. I thought I was going to be the hardest dude on the block and all this. You know, every other word was cuz, and that was just what I was doing. You know, and then you know when two things happened. My cousin gave me that tape, and there was a program called Ujima that came to my school that kind of teach young African American men their history and their culture. And they gave me a copy of the autobiography of Malcolm X and a copy of the autobiography of Frederick Douglass. And those reading those books and listening to that music, it took away the pain of where I was, which opened my eyes to where I could go and where I could be and what I could do. We'll be right back.
speaking of breaking all the rules, you did a couple covers on this. One of them is of a classical piece by Debussy called Clair de Lune.
Yeah, yeah.
A classic classical piece. Let's just take a listen to that. Would you ever want to play with the Los Angeles Philharmonic?
Oh, that would be beautiful.
Yeah.
That would be amazing. Absolutely.
Maybe that'll happen.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me. This
is
so cool.
My pleasure. It was really fun. Kamasi Washington. That's it for us. To the Point is next, so keep it right here on KCRW. Have a great Labor Day, and I'll see you tomorrow.